right, we're talking to Jason O'Brien, who was at Wacky doing nights. Exactly when, Jason?
Actually, I started at Wacky in September of 1971, and when I first went there, I was hired to do 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. After about the first 3 or 4 months, I've forgotten who the night guy was working at Wacky, but they left. And so for about another 6 months after that, I worked 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. plus 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. And we went through the spring book, and I know that John Randolph was actively looking for people, you know, for that slot. And the book came out. They'd actually put up a contest. The person that had the best ratings would win a trip somewhere. And nights went up pretty dramatically, and I got to keep the gig.
Cool. Now, how did you get to Wacky?
I was working at WRFC in Athens, Georgia, and I was going to school at the University of Georgia. The program director at the time knew that I wanted to move on to some larger markets, and I had the opportunity to go to work at WQXI in Atlanta, the old Quixie. This guy said, no, if you're going to go to work any place, the only place I'm going to let you leave here to go to is Wacky in Louisville. Well, I really didn't know a lot about Wacky, and I sent a tape to John Randolph, and he sent a tape back of what the station sounded like, and I was just blown away. And I was really lucky to get the job. I remember I met John. He was on his way to a wedding, and I met him in Atlanta on a Saturday night at Underground Atlanta. We had Indian food. It's one of those funny things how you remember stuff like that. But I had a wisdom tooth infection at the same time, and I had a 7-hour air shift that I did on Sundays at the station in Athens. And I was just dying the whole time. But for whatever reason, John must have felt sorry for me or whatever, but he brought me on board.
And the rest is broadcasting history.
Something like that.
All right. And you were at Wacky how long now?
From September 71 to August 73.
Going back to 71, some of the things you noticed about Wacky, I guess, being big-time radio compared with where you worked before?
Again, I grew up hearing Atlanta, you know, Quixie, and I could hear WLS. Used to listen to ABC a lot. We'd get CFL. So being able to hear major market radio was not that new. I just never heard a radio station quite like WAKY. I think the thing that was strange to me about it is I was used to jingling out of a commercial stop set into a record, whereas when I first went to Wacky, it was a kind of a holdover from the WABC chime time deal. It was just a real short thing, WAKY, and it had a chime on the end of it. You jingled into the stop set, which was kind of different for me. But everything was very produced. Everything was very tight. I remember that we had intros on commercials that would actually tell you how many seconds you had, because we walked the post on just about everything, or you would overlap. And if it was a dry voice commercial, you might start the song up underneath the dry voice spot toward the end and then hit a shout right before the post, and you were there. It was a very, very produced radio station.
How would you describe the Jason O'Brien show to people who haven't listened to your air checks online?
I was the kid jock, you know. I was there for the kids. It was a pretty high-energy thing at first, and I did a lot of school appearances. They had me out and about. There was a company out of Philadelphia called Rick Trow Productions, and they did a thing called The History of Rock and Roll. They did another one, too, that was sponsored by different people. And it was a good way for the jocks to be able to get out and about in the schools and do these school assembly programs under the guise of educational programming or education. And we do these school assemblies during the course of a book. I must have hit just about every school in Louisville. We did that twice. And it was a lot of fun. But I was the teen jock.
Now, I've heard from Mason Lee Dixon, I guess, who was working at Wacky before you. They had a show in the middle of the night, a talk show. Did you have to do any of that when you were doing the overnight show?
No, I did not. Actually, Mason came on the air at 9, and then from like midnight to 1 or something, he did this talk show that they classified as public affairs. He just had a bunch of different people on, and I came on at 2 o'clock, and we went back into a music format, because the overnight shift at Wacky when I first went there was 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., but Mason did do that. It was a strange thing to me, but hey, it worked, so.
Let's talk about some of the folks that you work with at Wacky. I'm going to throw some names at you, and let me know what you think of them.
Okay.
A guy you probably saw every day when you were doing the overnight show, Bill Bailey.
Oh, I love the guy. I truly thought that he was probably the best storyteller that has ever been on the face of the planet. I used to be amazed to listen to the man, and I'd be on my way back home listening to him, and I couldn't tell if he was making stuff up or not. There was one morning, I remember one particular bit that he did, and he was doing this thing about, well, the Duke had a romantic evening last night. And he now has that gravelly voice. And he would talk about the fact that he'd taken a bath by candlelight and everything was by candlelight. And it went on for about 45 minutes until you finally learned that Louisville Gas and Electric had cut his power off. And I remember he got on the air, it was probably close to 8:45. "My friends, my good neighbors, and my good friends, I demand that you call Louisville Gas and Electric and have the Duke's electricity turned back on." About 9 o'clock, 9:30, I think the president of LPNL called Don Myers, who was the general manager at the time, called him and said, "Stop it. We've had enough calls. We'll turn the guy's electricity back on." And then there was one morning in the early 70s when I was working there that Bailey used to park his car. He was running late. He'd park it in the alley behind the car, and he got towed off one morning, and he got on the air and called the police chief a son of a bitch. But I admired the man so much, and again, he was the greatest storyteller I'd ever seen. I was always amazed at how he could work. He was always nattily attired. You know, I hated those mornings where he was late because you just knew that you can't fill in for the Duke of Louisville. That's a hard gig.
All right, Gary Burbank.
Oh, man, what a voice. Burbank had just an incredibly deep voice. I would have loved to have been able to mimic. But the funny thing about Gary was he was just a wild and crazy man. I mean, he was kind of like Jonathan Winters and Robin Williams rolled into one. Gary just thought differently about the world. I remember one afternoon, Gary did a 2 to 6 or something on Saturday afternoon as well, because I did like a 10 to 2 on Saturday. And Lynn King was doing news in the afternoons. Burbank and Lynn were really big friends. They loved to crack each other up. So Lynn King is in a newscast one afternoon, and Gary decided to try to break Lynn up on the air. And he pulls out his, you know, he's going to urinate on the window. He's going to pee on the window. Well, of course, this breaks Lynn up, but Gary's standing up in a chair, some kind of chair, and he loses his balance. And he falls off the chair, and all we see is this fountain of water just spurting up. And that did break Lynn up pretty dramatically.
That's funny even thinking about it.
It was a funny place to work. I mean, Gary was just a sick guy, and he was an incredibly good talent. I mean, this guy really used to do a lot of scripting. He would do a lot of show prep. You know, you didn't want to be in the studio when Gary was in there because, you know, him and his alter ego. And it was kind of like, okay, you didn't want to go in there until, like, the last record or something was on until you had the shift change over.
Did you work much with Dude Walker?
You know, not really. I mean, I would see Dude when I'd come in. We were doing the last contest. I did all the production. So there were periods of time when I was there during the day. I would do that 6 to 9 shift, and I'd be in the studio just about all day long during that stupid promotion. It was a great, great promotion. But I loved his voice, too. Walker was just so smooth, and I remember that he used to do a lot of public opinion feedback, and he was well-liked by the ladies.
When you were doing nights, who came on after you?
Mason Dixon was there first when I first got there, and when Mason left, it was Lee Masters that came after him.
What was Lee Masters like to work with?
Lee was a very energetic guy, very focused, very driven. I remember he used to wear these funky sweaters to work sometimes and bring tea and honey for his voice, but he had a knack for programming. Really a brilliant guy.
How about Mason Lee Dixon?
Mason was really into astrology at the time. He was always trying to do people's signs, you know, their astrological signs. I remember he had this leather jacket with a lot of fringe on it. I don't know, Mason was just kind of a free spirit. You know, if radio wasn't his first love, that's what he did. And I think when he left Wacky, I think he went to St. Louis for a time, and we kind of lost touch with one another. But nice guy, really nice guy.
Anybody else, DJ-wise, you remember working with at Wacky?
Let's see, Mike Griffith was a production director, and Mike worked, I think, an overnight on Sunday. Chris Lundy had an incredible voice, too. The only other people that I, you know, vividly remember at the station were, of course, Reed Gayton. The team with Reed and Bailey in the morning, that was pretty incredible. And then there was Lynn King did news. There was a guy by the name of Woody Stiles. Woody took Gary up flying one afternoon. I remember that they got in trouble with the FAA because Woody wouldn't move out of the way for an American Airlines jet that was trying to land at the airport there. But I think later Woody got killed in a plane crash. you know, there was John Randolph, too. One of the things that Johnny was a good teacher, and he would sit and go through with air checks, and there were times where he didn't like what he had to say, but he was a good teacher and a good guide. And I always consider it a privilege to work there, considering how bad I was. I'm always amazed that they actually paid me to be on the air and do that. But I had a great time doing it. Randolph only did a two-hour shift per day. And I asked John, I said, well, why do you still do that? And he says, because I want to see how the format's executed on the air. I want to hear how the station sounds myself, and I want to see how it flows. You know, John was very much a personality, you know, situation. He wanted you to kind of focus on some things, but he wanted you to have a good time on the air. He let the personality come out. Very smart guy. And I remember sometimes I would ask John, I said, hey, how come, you know, we're not playing this song that WLS in Chicago is playing or WCFL or something? He says, because this is Louisville, Kentucky, and I programmed the station to the people that live here. You know, there were a lot of crossover songs that John played, both from a country aspect and from an urban aspect. He played, just like a lot of stations in the South did at the time, played an awful lot of black product. John was a big country fan, and he broke the Donna Fargo. I think he was the first person to ever play the Donna Fargo, Happiest Girl in the whole USA, on a top 40 station. And he would day part that. John was pretty good about day parting songs. The other thing I remember about him is he loved, and he would use the term wrestling. Not wrestling, but wrestling. And he and Burbank and a number of people used to go, I think it was on Monday nights at some place in Louisville, they'd go to the wrestling events. There was a skimmer in the back room. You were constantly air-checked. Also, the jingle, that W-A-K-Y with the chime on the end of it, that sat in that same back room. It was on a pot by itself. And how we did those things about we put somebody on the air, we used to have an old Coda phone. You'd have to sit there, and we'd take, a lot of times you could put it in an audition channel and run it off on a reel-to-reel and time it. I remember we had one of those gray photographic lab timers sitting up on the thing, so that anytime you started the turntables, then that gray lab photo clock would start timing backwards. That's how we did it. Probably one of the funniest things, John, that I remember also, that they used to put up this thing. This was on a Saturday. Never will forget this. They put up a sign in the window because the newsroom between you and them, you could talk to them, but a lot of times they just put up a sign that said what the link of the news was, right, as far as the headline. It'd be something like 8 seconds, 9 seconds, or something like that. And for whatever reason, I think on the weekends we played every other record as an oldie. And I never will forget this one. It was 20 men die in Kentucky coal mine disaster. Details at 20 past the hour on WAKY 2020 News. Working in a coal mine going down.
Oh, that's great. That's excellent.
It was just 9 seconds, and, you know, it was like, okay. Because, again, you tried to walk everything to the post. Now, on the air, there was this great big German reverb. It was a plate reverb, and it was back in the back storage room. And it was covered in a pad, like a great big moving pad. It sat very far away from anything, because it had a microphone at one end, and if anybody actually went back there and talked, you could actually hear it on top of the programming if somebody were doing a voice spot or something on the air.
Now, when you were on the air, you had somebody there answering the phones for you, right, especially
yeah.
at night?
Yeah.
Now, did you ever do any interaction at all with listeners on the radio?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we put a lot of people on the air. I mean, you know, we'd backtime that. We'd find somebody that we were looking for, or sometimes we'd prompt people, here's what we want you to say or whatever, or we'd just take a request off the Coda phone. I think Kevin used it for dates a lot of time, and I had to shake him up every once in a while. No, talk to these people. Get them on the phones. I remember Walker using that a lot, too. I forgot what kind of compressor we had. It was nothing I'd ever seen before. It wasn't particularly clean, but, boy, it would squash the sound. I remember John talking about an 8KC line and a 15 kilohertz line out to the transmitter. The remote control was one of those old Schaefer dial-up remote controls. One of the reasons I was hired is because back at that time you had to have a first-class license. I remember when I first went up there doing the all-nights, I was supposed to join the union. I never did, much to the dismay of the chief engineer. And I remember having that first, and I was the guy that had to take it directional or whatever, but I'd constantly put it over back on the 8KC line because it sounded better. You could actually hear a difference on the air, and it was loud, too. I remember driving up when I first went to the station on my way there. Don't ever ask your friends how to get someplace because they'll give you the long roundabout way. I hit Lexington and I could hear the station and I didn't know anything about Kentucky. Lexington was about 60 miles away, so I hit Lexington. I thought I was in a suburb of Louisville. The station was so strong and so loud. It was two-tower directional during the day at 5,000 watts during the day and a kilowatt at night with four towers. And when I first went up there, they had self-supporting towers.
Now, you didn't have to work at the transmitter.
No, I didn't have to work at the transmitter. I'd go out to the transmitter, though, because I was real curious about the audio processing. Randolph would go out and mess with the processing, probably to the chagrin of Doc, who was the chief engineer.
Tell me about the Wacky Production Studios. What were those like in the early 70s?
Two main studios, I think there was a Gates board in there, in the main production studio where Mike worked on, and for the most part, most of the jocks would just come in and do voiceovers, and Mike would put all the stuff together. There were, I think, two big Scullies in there. There may have been another Ampex in there. I think there were a couple of turntables and maybe three cart machines. And then there was another Overflow production studio, which is where I did. They had this old Gates yard, but if you absolutely had to go on the air, it had four or five cart machines in it. And I remember we put together these Christmas programs, and we actually had to go in and use that studio to be able to build it. So, I mean, really there were two, you know, full-time production studios, but Mike was the one that really did most of the production work. He put most everything together. Mike was really, really, really good.
Why was Wacky so special? What really separated Wacky from WKLO, another good top 40 radio station in Louisville?
KLO was very formatically driven. They were a little edgy. They were a little more stilted. When I first went there, they were not as musically focused, I don't think, as Wacky. The other thing is that KLO was not nearly so much involved in community as Wacky. I mentioned to you that I'd done the school things. We were constantly appearing at some place, whether or not it was a Catholic youth organization on Sunday nights or the Bell of Louisville. I was chairman of the March of Dimes. I don't know, one of their campaigns where we, you know, did a march. The station was constantly involved, you know, whether or not it was the world's largest free picnic or that type of thing. That was very avant-garde for back in the 70s, people throwing, you know, events where 30 or 40,000 people would come out. That really wasn't done, a whole lot of free concerts back then, and it was just a special station. I mean, the station just sounded different, too. I remember from an EQ point of view, we had this Gates board, and right in the middle of it was this little thing that you could push this filter in. It'd punch up the highs, and you could roll off some of the lows. And John had done that along with just squashing it from a compressing point of view, and the station was just very energetic sounding.
Why do you think Wacky is so fondly remembered today by people not only from the Kentuckiana area, but also people that follow great top 40 radio stations?
It was just one of those stations that it sounded big, and a lot of that had to do with both, you know, the technical aspect of it and the production values. Again, when I mentioned to you the fact that you had intros on the spots, and remember at this point in time, there were no sequential cues. When you, you know, went from one spot to another, you were pressing the buttons. There was a lot of pride in the aspect that this station was somewhat different and just extremely tight and very focused. It just sounded big. It sounded bigger than life. Sometimes you can just hear a station and the energy that emanates from it, the tightness, the production values, all of those things help to contribute, I believe.
So why'd you leave?
I left to go to work at a station in Birmingham, and I stayed there all of 3 weeks because I got lied to by somebody, and I'm not going to go into that who it was, but Gary knew I was unhappy there, and I followed Gary to NOE in New Orleans about a month later.
Now, were you unhappy at working at Wacky?
At Wacky, there were some things that happened toward the end that I didn't understand that John was making a change with. I mean, if there was any unhappiness on my part, it was the aspect that I got tired of playing Donnie and Marie Osmond. But I love the people there, and I couldn't say anything bad about it at all. I mean, my time there was just incredible, and everybody there was wonderful to me.
And real quickly, what did you do after NOE?
Gary left NOE, and I became program director of NOE. And that station was one of those larger-than-life radio stations, too, and I learned a lot of that from John. I wanted to go back to Georgia and talk myself into a station manager's position back in Georgia. Stayed there a year. Went to work at WVEE in Atlanta as an account executive, and actually stayed there 15 years as an AE, LSM, GSM, and after that, I went on to be a general manager. I've owned some stations and still in radio.
Looking back on your broadcast career, was Wacky a highlight, or was Wacky just pretty much a stepping stone?
Oh, Wacky was definitely a highlight. I mean, here I was, 21 years old, at this great station. I mean, really, I did not know how good that radio station was that I was applying for. I mean, it was just an incredible station, and I was so lucky to have been there, so it was definitely a highlight. And I remember that a lot of air checks run on me by a lot of markets. I remember one afternoon, I think it was Gene Chenault came in, interviewed Burbank for either KFRC or KHJ, I can't remember. I don't know where it really happened to that other than Gary was still there. Gary was just, you know, he was an incredible person too. I think it was just the chemistry of the people. So it was obviously, you know, early on to learn from guys like that. Man, what wouldn't be to love?